Welcome to another episode of the Vet Med Mind Behind the Journey, where we dive deep into the stories of those who shape the veterinary profession with their dedication, innovation, and passion. Today, we're thrilled to welcome David Liss, a standout leader in the vet med business world. Blending impressive academic credentials, including an MBA, CVPM, and PHR, David has led the way in veterinary practice management and currently serves as the Director of West Coast Operations for Veterinary Emergency Group. In addition to his incredible career, he has been recognized with awards like Speaker of the Year at WVC and RVT of the Year by Southern California Vet Medical Association. So let's dive into a conversation that promises to inspire right here on the Vet Med Mind. All right, David, it's so nice to have you here. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Oh my gosh, thank you for having me. It's great to see you again and connect with you. Super excited to be here.
Yeah, it has been a minute since we've seen each other, and I'm excited to catch up with you as well, because you were doing some really amazing things and you've had an incredible career. And that's really also what I want to focus on today is you are somebody who I know myself and so many other people look up to in the career that you've had, because especially I feel like from my experience, starting as a technician, I started as a kennel attendant. I was cleaning kennels and scooping poop and the whole fun thing about that. You know, I think about my career when I first started doing janitorial work with the pleasure of petting a dog every so often. But, you know, I saw my career path as this. I saw it as I'm just going to do my time picking up some poop, cleaning some messy kennels.
Yeah.
And then I'm going to become a technician. And then I'm going to become a doctor. The end, ribbon, done. Now, I didn't go on to the doctor path. So then when I knew I didn't want to do that, I was like, oh, career path over. That was actually a significant moment for me. And
right.
You have really, I think, opened up, you know, the levels of vet tech work and all the places you can go through management and all sorts of things. So I am so excited to dive into your career because it's incredible.
Thank you.
For those of you who don't know or haven't like read the synopsis of this podcast yet, David has alphabet soup behind his name. He is a knower of all things. And just so excited. So I want to talk about your career and your journey and your leadership evolution, moving from a technician, ER, ICU, into a business leader, HR professional. I know that's a huge question, but just kind of talk me through how you started and how you started making those connections into these other areas that interested you.
Sure. Well, thank you so much for the intro, and I appreciate it. And it's great to be here. You know, it's funny you mentioned veterinary school, and I was on a similar path and got rejected from vet school. Which is not uncommon, but when you have the mindset of that's the only thing that you can do in vet med, as you said, significant, I would say it was devastating for me. And I had to, you know, really figure out what the heck I wanted to do in my next step. So I was fortunate that I had already become an RVT at that point. And so I had kind of credentials, and I felt really proud of myself being a veterinary technician. And so I continued, you know, kind of through that path and figured what was the next thing, and vet tech specialist was getting highlighted. So I think that's essentially, but, you know, kind of going back to the beginning, same thing. I worked on kennels. I gave, you know, dogs and cats, you know, pills and oral meds, and, you know, watched the technicians work. And, you know, this was, probably, oh gosh, late 90s, early 2000s, and, you know, small general practice. So nobody had a license. I mean, the veterinarians did, but nobody else did. And within like a year, I was intubating dogs and doing dentals, which I definitely should not have been looking back. But I think many of us chuckle because that's the way it was. It was a lot of learn on the job, trade type stuff. So I looked at the veterinarians and I felt that I could do that and went on the path. And so I had finished college and, you know, I just didn't have like the minimum GRE score to just make it through the threshold of thousands of other people that were applying. But I took it so personally, right? Like, I'm in vet med and I'm enjoying life and I've connected with so many doctors. How could I get rejected? And so I just, you know, had that that part in my life where I was working in Los Angeles at that point, making decent money back in the day as a RVT shift worker in ICU, and just thought, you know, I could kind of roll with this for a while. And it was probably a little bit of, you know, kind of shame and suppression of the upset of not getting into vet school. And VTS came along my way. I heard about folks that were, and I, you know, found the application, started to work on it, talked to my criticalist that worked at the hospital, said, would you help sponsor me? He said, yes. You know, continuing to shoot high. And listen, rejection sucks and it's really tough, but you do pick yourself up and you move on. So I've shot high in a lot of times, and I've not made it every single spot I've tried, but VTS was the path. I thought clinical medicine was the path. And I think that I started to realize that, you know, there has to be an intellectual engagement for me, and some sort of connection with a person that can challenge me and push me. And so I started to think about people leadership at that point, or management, supervisory, whatever you want to call it, because it started to give me more of that push and pull of what I needed intellectually, the debate, even the upset employee that's really upset about something. I like talking to them and I like trying to figure out, why are they so upset? And, you know, like, I'm asking you to come in on time. What's the big deal? You know? And so I enjoyed that kind of, I don't know, my dad was a lawyer. Maybe there's a little bit of that, you know, debate piece. And so long story short, I took, you know, supervisory roles. I started to feel like I was decent at it and that I, you know, and it was challenging for me. So I started to look at manager roles, took a couple manager roles. And long story short, I ended up taking a program director role for a vet tech program. It was a startup. For about 7 years, I did that. And obviously very challenging to build a program and then get it to kind of coast. And then, you know, wanted to go back into the clinical side of things. Ended up as a hospital manager and then eventually a regional director. So, you know, I think you just, you know, I'm somebody that keeps pushing. I'm somebody that, you know, is very loyal to a company and to my boss and to all of the things. But, you know, if I don't begin to feel or see advancement for myself, I am going to look elsewhere. And I've been able to do that and move through the ranks and, you know, made very kind of tactical changes in my life and career promotions. And each time, you know, you're day one, so you're learning how to do the career. And so, you know, now I'm work for Veterinary Emergency Group and I'm, you know, very happy and we're building a lot of hospitals and it's super challenging and exciting. And I think, you know, as a younger professional as well, the kind of startup mentality is really exciting. And so, you know, just been really, really lucky too. The other thing that I think all of the listeners of the podcast can think about is that veterinary medicine is truly an explosive industry. There is everything from startups that are working on crazy tech, you know, or drugs or whatever, all the way up to big pharma like Zoetis. And so with that comes literally a million opportunities, literally. And so look for the skies, be on Indeed and LinkedIn all the time and, you know, kind of go where your heart tells you.
It's so true. The possibilities really are truly endless. And in meeting so many people within the industry and finding out the amazing things that they're doing and all these sort of tangential companies, and there really are. And again, you know, a lot of that when I was in practice was my own lack of research and understanding. You know, I think a lot of us who get into that industry do have that laser focus on vet school and really just, not that there's a lot of noise coming from anything else, at least not when I was in that position. I didn't feel like other parts of the industry were calling my attention so much or being big enough to be like, that's interesting over there. Like, what's that sparkly thing, you know? And so I was so laser focused that I really had shut myself off. And of course, went through the moment when vet school, when I realized it just wasn't going to be a reality for me, I thought, well, what am I going to do now? Like, I really thought my career in vet med was over. And I know I'm not the only one who feels that, you know, and who just was like, that's it then. I guess this is where it ends. And that was kind of devastating for me too, just to think like, you know, I remember looking at grad programs and like physical therapy, like, you know, fine, it's a fine job, but am I passionate about that? No, it wasn't really my passion. And so I think it's really amazing to hear not just about you exploring. It was more about, it sounds like you were recognizing that there were gaps, things you want to know more about, things that you got excited about. And you said something interesting sort of about that intellectual challenge that you really wanted to kind of have either with the work itself, with another person. And so with all the experiences then that you've had in your career, what was some of the influence of those past experiences on your leadership style?
That's a great question. You know, I think a lot of it is truly trial and error. And I think that a lot of new leaders are really scared to fail. And so they amp themselves up and tie themselves in a ton of knots. Look, you're going to say the wrong thing. And you need great people around you, including bosses and as you said, tangential support, like people partners or HR or whatever, to just show you where you messed up and help you get better at it. I remember times where I was working crazy amounts of shifts. I was a tech supervisor, hourly supervisor at a big specialty hospital. You know, this is years ago. We had a bunch of, as always, right, staffing issues and a bunch of callouts. And I can't remember if I'd put the pressure on myself or my boss had told me that you need to kind of sign up for all these open shifts if nobody does. I think I probably put the pressure on myself, to be frank. And I was just burned out after, I don't know, 5 or 6 days on the floor. And it was like a Saturday night. And I literally just had dinner and movies planned the whole night. But I got a call that somebody had called out and they were calling me in. And I just said, I'm not coming in. And the staff member was, you know, like, you can't do that. It was very incensed and it was very upset. And we both called our boss and it was a little bit childish, to be honest. But you know, I look back on that and I go, okay, I was overworking myself, right? And I had to set up some boundaries and say, you know, and you learn that as a supervisor or a leader, right? A manager saying, hey guys, you know, I'm really sorry, but nobody's going to be on call tonight. How do we make sure that you guys are okay until the morning, right? Versus, oh, I'm just going to save this and I'm going to do that. You know, that's one example. Another example is, having gone from on the floor to supervisor, so befriending some of these employees. And I was always, I think, had enough of a separation at work to understand like the employees are not my friends, but I enjoyed working with them. But I had to then transition and I had to give a performance review to an employee who was a grumpy grump, but not like an aggressive person, just grumpy. And then we were having this interaction about a performance review, and she just starts breaking down crying. You know, she's obviously got a lot of built up stress and anxiety and all these other things going on. And so learning how to be really empathetic in the moment. And you just do that by being in it for a long time. I also learned that, you know, we know some of these things are true. People love to talk about themselves. And so as a leader, I often talk less about myself. We're quick to have opinions and it's great. And I think consultants are great about this, but when you're a manager, when you're working in an employee related situation, you're not a consultant, right? It's not just about your opinion. So you listen to the employees, hear their point of view. I've learned a lot about interacting with adults. You don't scold or tell adults what to do because they're adults. They go, F you, I'm 18, you know, over 18, I'm out of here. You have to say, you know, why do you feel or see the thing this way that you do? And they have to speak from that lived experience and their position of values or whatever it is. And then you work at that alignment level. And sometimes you have to say a little bit of like, look, I know you really don't get it, but like, we all just have to follow the rules. Like there's a little bit of that kind of, come on now, right? Versus like, you have to, you know, that just doesn't work. So there's all of those things that I think I've truly just learned over a career and experience in management and, you know, learning a lot, listening to Brené Brown and reading all kinds of psychological books and stuff. I think coming from that, the ground up versus the top down approach has worked well. And it's just been from sheer experience.
Thinking back when I was in practice, I think that at the time I thought I was doing the right thing by trying to get everyone involved and making everybody happy. And I think that a lot of managers struggle in that area because we want to avoid conflict at all costs. And so there can definitely be some, I think, blurred lines a little bit between are the decisions I'm making, are the conversations I'm having truly still coming from a place where I do feel like I have that autonomy still as a leader, thinking of the long-term strategy of the practice to truly make the decision that is best for the business while also taking into account these positions? Or am I trying to push off the responsibility and not willing to kind of take ownership of this, even though I'm trying to get the team involved? Because I think that that's sort of that balancing act is I want the team involved, but I'm still a leader, right? I still have to see it through. I still have to execute on that. I still have to hold people accountable. And for me, that was that misstep is I'm worried that I was going to make the wrong choice. So it was like, let's get more people involved. So it's like, so we can sort of have this like group decision. And again, I was like a young manager trying to figure it out for myself as well. But it is definitely an interesting thing to reflect on, to recognize what your behaviors are as a leader over the course of time and think about what style was I truly working with and how did that work for me and the team and the business overall? And again, over the course of your time in management and leadership, do you take a lot of time to sort of reflect? Is that a part of your process?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's so many things came up for me as you were chatting. It's super interesting. You know, one of the things that I think about is that journey that you were talking about, I really think is the beginnings of building the what I call the executive skill set. So rather than being in the chair of a manager role where your team comes to you and you make decisions on the fly and quickly, and it's essentially always your decision, that's a role of the manager. And I completely understand, you know, no, you can't have the day off. No, you can't do X, Y, Z. But when you are brought, when a decision is brought to you from somebody who could be the maybe not the key decision maker, but the executor of the decision, and you say, let me think about it, and you start to put it into a framework of what's the business risk, what's the, you know, what's the reputation risk, what's the financial risk, you know, what's the gain on all of those sides, and okay, this makes the most sense, and I can sign my name to it, but you're going to execute on it. That's the beginnings of being an executive. And so it's great that you thought through that, because you're right. It's easy to hide behind that and let other people make decisions. I think the biggest thing, and this is bringing me to your point or your question, is yeah, you have to reflect and think to yourself, there is no right or wrong decision. There's a lot of shades of gray. But what you need to have is a position on the decision. So for example, if you're the practice owner, right? You guys deal with a lot of private practices, the practice owner or the group of owners, if it's a partnership, or, you know, the board, if it's a small, you know, group or whatever of hospitals, would say, you know, why did you make that decision? Da, 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 da. You just have to have a reason and a position. And if you've thought that out from A to Z, and it can't just be because, right? It has to be, well, I figured that this would drive an increased volume and the increased volume would lead me all this down this path. They might not be happy with you. It might've been the wrong decision, but you had a position. And that's where I think you're talking about. And so in order to get there, you have to do a lot of reflection. So that's, I absolutely do. There are times when I make snap decisions, and they turn out right or not right or wrong, but they turn out good or bad, meaning it either worked or it didn't. And I say, oh, you know, if the decision works, I try not to get into a bias of my head of, oh, I need to make more snap decisions. I say, well, I made a snap decision. Could I have sat on that decision? Was that an emergency decision? Was that an urgent decision, right? Using that Eisenhower matrix and thinking what's urgent, not urgent, emergent. And then I sometimes say, yeah, it felt urgent. It felt emergent, but you know what? I could have put it into my queue. I could have thought about it over a few days and then gotten back to the team member about it, because the team members always think whatever they bring to you is urgent, right? Or basically on fire. So that's one piece. But the other piece of that, what I do is I just look at the outcomes of every decision, good or bad. And I say, you know, what led into it? What was my thought process or my position at the moment? And if it was good, I just say, you know what? I won that day. Great. It was awesome. Some days I go, I really lost that day. That didn't go so well. And a lot of times this stuff is either, I find that it's usually in two categories. One is with people. So either I thought out this thing and this way that I was going to bring something up and I went into the conversation and they just were so upset. Well, that approach didn't work, right? And you can't predict people. So I never try to, but I just think through, you know, where was my mind at or what could I've done differently? What did I miss? What was the position, their position that I missed? And the other side of it is on the business side, you know, you launch an initiative or you, you know, cut a cost or do something. And then you try to predict that second, third, and fourth order effects of all of that. And then you say, oh, it didn't work out. The staff are revolting. I got to reverse. Or you go, oh, that really worked out well. And nobody really noticed. I think a great example is like converting from phone calls of normal blood work to text messages. The clients are going to freak out. Nobody's going to like it. I've launched it at about 6 practices now. I guarantee you nobody's called and said, I don't get a phone call anymore. This place has changed. They literally don't notice it, right? So it's just those type of, that it's scary, right? You're ripping a Band-Aid off. You're changing. And so absolutely tons of reflection is needed. I journal. I have a notes app. I ask sometimes if I'm in the car, I will turn on my the voice recorder thing and just talk and like record notes. And it's a great way to work through leadership anxiety too, because if you're nervous about a decision or you've made a decision and you're nervous about how it's going to go, just talk to yourself through it. What was I thinking? What was my process? What are the risks? And if you know all of that, that's all you really can do at the end of the day.
I love that so much. Again, in reflecting when I was in practice last, and especially my last practice was a specialty practice, I felt a huge amount of imposter syndrome, which I didn't and wasn't willing to accept or give any sort of recognition to in the moment. In retrospect, I'm very, very able to see that I felt like I was in over my head. And I truly was like, you know, in honestly thinking, how did I trick these people into giving me this job? Right. Like but I didn't lie about anything and they seem to think I'm capable. Right. So, right. As you can imagine, that snowball, that turned into quite an avalanche, but I felt like I had so much to prove. I felt like I had carried so much importance and everything had so much weight. And I know this because, you know, when I talk to everyone, you know, hundreds of practices over the years and at our workshops, there's something about the pace. And I don't know if it's just because we work in hospitals. And even though the leadership management doesn't necessarily have to follow the fast pace-ness of our appointment flow and all of the patients moving around and like literally the activity, like the physical movement of people around us, like we work in such an active place. And I think that I felt this, like you said, not just everything from my team felt like it was on fire. I felt like everything was on fire. I felt like, and maybe this was also part of the culture of my practice and visionary that was my leader and everything seemed important. It was really hard to prioritize. And so I felt like every day I was running a marathon. I didn't think about a decision. Like that's insanity. Like who has time to think? So I I'm glad that you said it because I think that we have to normalize that yes, we have to make a better effort to recognize that when people are coming in with this dumpster fire, that maybe it's not a dumpster fire, right? Like maybe it isn't as big as it seems just because they literally walked into your office quickly and they're out of breath and their tone of voice is high and loud. You're clearly panicked and you know, that doesn't have to transition. And so what are some of the boundaries that you have in place to help you? Like, I mean, the Eisenhower matrix and all that, but I imagine a lot of what you have to do is also make those employees who come to you with that level of energy and with that level of intensity to say, whoa, like how can we also, because I mean, you know that the impact of their energy on the practice is not going to help any either. So what are your strategies and how do we get everybody to recognize that maybe this isn't as big of a problem as it seems right now?
Sure. Yeah. So there's a couple things there. You know, the first one is, so in any system, right? Like if you think about the body, there are the microscopic things that happen. So there's the, and I'm using some biology examples, but there's like the red blood cell and the like tissue and like moving oxygen and stuff, which happens at lightning speed. And then you zoom all the way out to something like the skin or the heart or something, which beats, but you know, but you're not thinking about all the little microscopic ionic things that are happening in the muscles. It's the same thing in a business, right? A business, I believe, is an entity and an organism and functions the same way. One of the problems with what you're describing, and I, it's nobody's fault, but I think we've built this on themselves, is that though there are those levels of decisions, there's decisions that need to happen immediately. For example, you know, trying to think of it, you know, Dr. So-and-so is three clients deep and needs to get into surgery, and the lunch person called out, right? You know, this is a fire, and it rolls all the way up. But then there's also problems that the hospital or the business faces that are large, like what am I going to do for the 2024 tax year, right? Like there's different levels of those things. So the way that I tackle this is twofold. One is day one, you start with, like, as you said, kind of asking the employee what the crisis is and why they think it's a crisis and kind of getting them to breathe and think and calm down. And in the beginning, as you're changing the ship, you probably have to solve a few crises on the fly, but it's not sustainable. So you have to start changing the ship. So then day two or day 30 or day 90, whatever you want to, you know, whatever time frame you want to add in, you have to start asking the employees or saying to them, you know, I'll put it in the queue. I'll put it in the queue. I'll get to it. And you have to create some mechanism by which they know that it's going to sit as a post-it note or a to-do or whatever, and you're going to follow up and get back to them about it. And I think that that a lot of time quells their fears too. And they say, okay, I've offloaded the problem to my boss, and I can trust, and this happens over time, but I can trust that they're going to look into it, follow up with it, research it. Same thing I feel like with a lot of client upset issues that, you know, clients will say, I demand to speak to a manager. I don't think they should have a manager right away. I think that front desk, and I get it, and I know that the clients are inappropriate to the front desk people, but they need to be able to say, I will take your information. The manager will call you and set an appointment. Like, you need to start creating those boundaries. The other part of this, though, that I think is truly deep and symptomatic is that the employees that come running into your office have never been empowered to solve their own problems, and they have to be empowered to solve their own problems. So, for example, if you're talking about a large hospital like the one you ran as a hospital administrator, your job, and I know that we talk about, like, you know, nothing is not our job. Your job is not to solve a call out on a Thursday. It's frankly, not even your nursing manager's job, right? It's technically the person on the floor. If there's a shift lead kind of person, great. If not, realistically, it's the person in the moment who unfortunately got the call out, like the IM tech whose other IM tech person called out, and the doctor, and they have to come together and do that. So you have to have conversations with them to say, guys, I'm not solving your problems anymore. You have to figure it out. This is something that I can't fix. It's going to take me a minute to finish my meeting or finish my whatever it is, pull up the employee list, make 13 phone calls. Like, none of this is getting solved in the moment. So I ask them, you know, what do you need to get through the rest of the day? And usually they'll say, I need, you know, in an ideal world, and they start to, what happens is you start to move the fear right from the amygdala to the frontal lobe, and they start thinking about how to solve their problem, and you make them part of the solution. And they'll say something like, for example, you know, I just can't do it. I really need you to cancel my 5 o'clock. I go, great, done. I'm going to call the customer and say, I'm very, very sorry. We're refunding you. We'll risk it, you know, whatever it is, right? You start figuring out there's ways to solve it. And then you tell them, guess what, guys? Next week, if this same thing happens, you have the authority to cancel an appointment, refund, and reschedule, and you don't have to come to me. And you start to build those building blocks so they don't run into your office rushing and out of breath.
I love that. And I love that accountability on the leadership side, you know, the trust. I think that's the big thing, is that if you're going to say to somebody that you hear them and that you are writing it down, it's in the queue, that you owe it to them to actually do that follow-up. Because otherwise, right, there won't ever be that trust them. They won't have that relief when they offload it, because they're going to be like, but you didn't do what I just said last time, you know, and I never heard back from you about that thing. And so from the accountability leadership side, that's so important. But I also want to talk to you about accountability on the team side, because again, I think that that's also a big struggle for a lot of leaders, and especially newer leaders and, you know, people that are, like I said, you know, I'm thinking about myself. I felt like I had to take everything on. And I took a lot of empowerment away from the team in that way. There was a lot of hand holding. There was a lot of safety netting. And I thought I was doing everyone all these favors. At least I thought that I was creating safety nets and support. And I think I just instead, you know, took a lot of power away from them. So I want to talk about team accountability, because as a leader, we do want to roll out initiatives. We want our practice to grow. We want our team members to grow. But that requires a lot of work on their side. And I know a lot of people hear a lot of pushback when things don't get done. Well, I have too much on my plate. Well, this, well, that, you know, and a lot of initiatives end up falling flat because we can't always get our teams to rally around some of these ideas and lean into the change that's required to do some of that for a lot, very legitimate reasons sometimes, and sometimes cultural. But what are your thoughts on that? How can we build more accountable teams as leaders? How can we lean on them as much as they can lean on us?
Yeah, those are all great points. I think, and I could be completely wrong, and I'm sure that some really smart people would have other great tools. But the way that I see it is there's kind of two buckets. The bucket one is you just have to do it. This is a top-down thing. We're rolling out, you know, text messaging or rolling out a new software, whatever it is. And, you know, you don't approach it from a stick versus a carrot. You do your best to hold team meetings, manage them through the change and say, guys, you know, we've made a decision as a management team to change practice management systems. It's cheaper. It's, you know, the other one's going away, whatever it is. We're going cloud, whatever. And we know that you guys aren't going to love it. And we're here and we're going to launch it in 3 months, not tomorrow, 3 months. Right. And then you have talking about it and then you go through it and then you prime them by seeing it. You do all the things. They may not love it. The other thing, the other types of initiatives that you can launch are things that actually solve their pain points, right? So, you know, for example, I mean, I can think of like new drugs that have come, so, you know, itchy dogs, right? Over the last 15 years, we've had a bunch of drugs that come out. So that's a pain point. You know, the customers come in, the technicians, the doctors see these itchy dogs. We give, you know, I don't know, shots of prednisone or whatever the heck they used to do forever ago. And then they launch, and I forget the dermatology names now, but they, what's that one that everybody gives for Adipy? Yeah, Apoquel, thank you. So Apoquel comes out, right? And the cool thing is that you could launch that as an initiative, right? You can price it, you can have strategy, you can have marketing around it. Some of those initiatives can be launched in that way. And so you get like immediate team buy-in. So it's really those two buckets. And the second bucket, which of course is the easier one when they have buy-in, you can do two ways. One is, you know, it comes from your idea or you hear about it at a conference. But the other thing is if you keep your pulse on the team and they say, you know, this is really tough. You know, when I try to schedule an appointment, this glitch happens or this thing happens or whatever, or the phone call, you know, the phones are scratchy, or, you know, you listen to all of their like issues and then you decide to iterate on the business. When you solve their issues with workflow, new drugs, new initiatives, in a business sense, you're actually helping them and you'll get buy-in initially. So I think a lot of the ways is just to listen to your customers and clients and listen to your employees, and that will almost present new initiatives and focuses for you to look at. And then you have the other side, which are basically live in the business decision camp, because it's not a perfect world. And listen, it is not, you know, it is a democracy to a certain extent, but, you know, somebody signs the paycheck. And so there are certainly situations where you say, guys, you're going to be upset. I'm really sorry. We're going to ride this change management wave, but this is happening and I've made that decision.
Yes, I love that. It's such a great point. And I feel like sometimes we just get so in our heads about everything and we forget that we're all on the same team, that we can have a truly authentic, real, transparent conversation, that we don't have to put on this coat of armor of manager, right? Like, okay, this is the role I have to play and whatever. We can talk about the challenges as they come up. we can expect that there will be challenges. I think that that's the other thing, is we all hope that these rollouts will be so perfect. And when we go back to old habits, it's a stumbling block. Now I want to, as we wrap up today, I want to kind of talk about just the defining and achieving success. Now, to me, you've been very successful on VetMed, and I love seeing all the things that you're doing, and you're really amazing. But I'm curious, how do you define success for yourself, and how do you view your career overall, and where do you see yourself going if you have those visions?
I think about that a lot in my career, and I think that I can speak, or probably hopefully will connect to a lot of folks on this podcast that are driven, smart, energetic people, who have that constant desire for learning, which you are, and many of your colleagues are, and there's that group of us, and not everybody's like that, and that's okay. But the folks that are, I really think that, I kind of think of like the hamster wheel analogy, right? You're continuing to grind and grind. I used to value success in promotions and all of that sort. And I think the reason we do that is because we do, and I hate to say it, and I know you've got a lot of small private practices on this podcast, but we do outgrow roles. And if you have a, two doctor practice that has 8 employees, and, you've managed a lot of the business, maybe you've gotten your CVPM, or you want to get your CVPM or your CVBL certifications, and you get to a certain point and you go, I want more. That's pretty natural and normal. And the reality is that your business, if it's privately owned, can't get there. Now, VGP comes in, right, and creates a network effect, and you have a lot of opportunities to interact with consultants like yourself. And so there's more there. But let's imagine it's not a VGP practice, it's just a standalone. That's okay, but you are going to wrestle with some internal strife of, I want more, I've done the thing for the longest time. So I think what you have to think about there is, what is the next step for you, and how would you get there? And I also think that, we have a finite time in this world. So there's a finite amount of time you're going to have those feelings. So you're going to want to grind, you're going to want to climb a ladder, you're going to want to take on. And then there is going to be a certain point in your life where you're going to have to start to be okay with plateau and look back and start to reflect. And I think that I'm getting to that point in my life as well, where I say, I've done a lot, I've seen a lot. I'm fairly secure and happy in my job. It ticks the boxes for me. I get the growth aspect, I get the people aspect, I get the business aspect, I get the partnership aspect with our corporate teams. And so for me, it feels good. And if something comes along, great, or if I'm promoted, great. But the reality is, what am I doing every minute of every day? And does it mostly 80% feel good? And if you're at the 80% mark, I think that's success. It's not 100%, and it never will be. So the minute that you hit a roadblock and you think, oh, I had a really bad day, or oh, it's really tough, our brain goes to bad places and thinks, oh, I should quit, I should, do something else. I think if you're just able to go to bed, get up the next day, and essentially keep your head in the grind of the job and focus and be able to focus on something, that's really helpful. And I do think for the practice owners out there, or the regional directors, or the corporate folks that own a lot of practices, you have to give people something to be grinding for. There has to be a vision. There has to be an inspiration. And you can do it in a 2-doctor small animal practice, right? You can, and it doesn't have to happen overnight. It can be, next year we're going to buy a new piece of equipment. Great. And the year after that, we're going to do this thing. And it could be every year you have some sort of focus or initiative or whatever, but you have to give people some of that. And I think that younger folks, millennial folks, are very vision driven. And so you can retain a lot more folks too, if you create that. And then that translates, I think, into us of really thinking about the balance between our selfish needs, which we have, like we want to grow in advance, and taking on more, and you're giving back to them. I think that's a pretty healthy balance, and probably defines some level of success.
I think that's fantastic. And I couldn't agree with you more. And kind of going back to what you were saying before too, you know, with that 80-20, it is so easy to have a bad day and say, I'm done. I'm over it. This is it. You know, because probably what's happened is you've had more than just that one day where that percentage hasn't been hitting. But it goes back to what you were saying about journaling, about talking to yourself in the car, about working through, you know, and being more connected to really how you're feeling on a regular basis. So it doesn't feel like one day you're ready to flip the table over, that you're sensing this is happening, this shift is happening, and there's opportunities and to intervene and to make the best choices for you and your career. And I'm sure all of these really productive and healthy habits that you've had have really allowed you to get to a place where you feel so successful and so comfortable and happy and just comfortable in doing what you're doing every day, right? And not always having that itchiness of like, oh, what's next?
Yeah.
So my final question to you, and you've given so much great advice so far, but I want to just have you reach back and think about yourself and when you were getting started and throughout this journey. If you want to go back and give yourself a piece of advice, what would that be?
That's always such a great question. I think in the moment, we think that the decision or the thing in front of us is make or break, do or die. You know, I didn't get into vet school, life is over, right? And as long as we stay relatively healthy and we're lucky in that, we have a pretty long life. We have 75 to 85 years on this earth. And so something is going to evolve and open. Just keep pushing. But don't be so hard on yourself if the thing that you wanted or needed or thought was going to happen didn't, you know. And I think that so many people think that way, but looking back, you know, it's all going to turn out okay. So don't lose sleep over it. Don't beat yourself up over it. You know, so many of us develop really toxic habits around that. And just tell yourself, you know, you're a valued member of the 5-6 billion people on the planet. You deserve to be here and it's all going to turn out okay.
Yes. And thank you for that. I think a lot of people needed to hear that from you today. So, David, I loved having you here. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I could talk to you all day. You're fantastic. So next time in California, I'm going to reach out. Love to sit down and talk about all the things. So
please do.
Thank you so much for being here.
It was great. I appreciated you guys having me on, and be well and best wishes to everybody out there.
You too. Thanks, David.